Hello, I'm Kelly D. Welcome to the very first episode of Watershed Moments, a show that highlights the work of the North Coast Watershed Association, or NCWA, and our partners. The North Coast Watershed Association is a nonprofit based in Astoria, Oregon, where I work as a project manager, and our mission is to improve watershed health through community-based efforts. And in a place with such a diverse landscape and a patchwork of land ownership, you folks listening, our community members around Clatsop County, you are so integral to our work and the work of our neighbor watershed councils serving the Nequanicum and Nehalem watersheds. We rely on our communities to help us find projects and to work with us to do things like planting vegetation along stream banks for riparian corridors, removing invasive plants that are impacting local biodiversity, letting us snorkel past your property to inventory where juvenile coho are hanging out, taking stream temperatures to monitor their fluctuation over the years, and so much more. Thank you for connecting with us and with the local ecosystem you're a part of. To learn more about us and our work and events, visit our website at clatsopwatersheds.org. Today's episode of Watershed Moments is all about habitat restoration projects. We'll take you to the North North Fork Klaskanine River, where we completed a fish passage project in 2022, and we'll learn about wetland restoration over the last 15 years happening around Colwort Creek at Lewis and Clark National Historical Park.
Okay. We're recording.
So in around mid-August 2022, the NCWA Executive Director, Graham Clagg, and I went to visit the site of one of our projects just above the Klaskanine Salmon Hatchery. You can hear some of that work being done in the background.
So we're underneath the 202 bridge over the North North Fork Klaskanine, where currently work is being done to remove or functionally remove the dam that has been the water intake for the Klaskanine hatchery. Is that right?
So we are here, yes, on one of the many forks of the Klaskanine River.
That's Graham.
This has some of the cleanest, best water quality that the hatchery here has been utilizing to grow salmon within the hatchery. So what this project is all about is preserving the hatchery's ability to get water from this system while also altering the face of the dam that allows for the water intake.
So, the Klaskanine hatchery, like most hatcheries, produces fish that can be caught by commercial and sports fisherfolk. The logic is that this takes the human predation pressure off of threatened wild fish populations, which is all of our wild salmon populations. These hatchery fish are distinguishable from wild fish because their adipose fin, which is on their back between their dorsal and tail fin, that is clipped before they're released. Unless they're chum salmon, in which case they're too small to be fin clipped, so they're marked in a crazy different way that we'll talk about in another episode. The first fin clipped fish in Oregon was released in 1898. 21 years after the first fish hatchery was built by the U.S. Fish Commission on the Clackamas River in 1877. Hatcheries have been around for a lot longer than I realized. In another episode, we'll go into detail about how spawning happens in hatcheries, but suffice it to say that at the hatcheries, baby salmon are made. Then they are released into the river after a couple of months or so, depending on the species, and spend 1 to 7 years out in the ocean where they migrate around before returning to fresh water to reproduce and to die. Lots of plants and animals do this, including spiders and most grain crops. This trait of using all your energy to reproduce and dying shortly after is called simulparity. And I'm not sure if I'm saying that right, so take it as you will. Steelhead, however, are different. They can spawn up to 4 times, according to the Center for Biological Diversity. and those who are repeat spawners seem to hold back some of their reproductive resources on their first go of it. And Oregon State University researchers think this is to fuel their return journey to the ocean, which is incredible and very ambitious. Anyhow, most hatchery fish come back to the hatchery they were released from because water from that specific river leaves a chemical signature in specialized neuroreceptor cells associated with the fish's nostrils. So after swimming around in the ocean for a while, salmon rely first on a sense of the Earth's magnetic field to get them close to their home. And once they're within 100 miles or so, they can use this chemical signature to sniff their way back. This is why hatcheries are specific to the river system they're situated on, and why they use water from that specific system to raise the baby fish. Dams at hatcheries also route water into traps to capture returning adults in order to generate the next year's brood stock. Wild fish that are caught in traps are sometimes moved above the hatchery by hand, literally loaded into tanks on trucks and driven around the dam so they can access the river above it. Also, Google fish cannons if you want to see another interesting fish passage workaround. In a way, these things are helpful as a means of controlling upriver spawning, only allowing wild fish to pass so that hatchery genetics remain separate, which is a pretty big issue. However, we don't necessarily need to truck fish to do that. And this is one of the issues that this project was aiming to mitigate, allowing wild fish to pass over the water intake dam on their own.
So we're building a roughened channel here, which is going to be at about a 3% grade and run all the way from the face of the dam in front of it, kind of front filling it so that there's basically, you know, a more, what I like to call a fish elevator, that the fish can actually get up and get through. And it'll look like a stream bottom when it's all done.
Right, so it's like a fish ADA ramp.
Sure, yes, you know, for geriatric fish as they return to their spawning grounds and need a little help.
And lamprey especially, yeah.
That's, I'm glad you bring that up. Actually, one of the main direct benefiters to this project will be Pacific lamprey and coastal cutthroat trout, because even though we're dealing with this dam issue, there is another issue which is in the works to be fixed just down the street at the hatchery, called the an OG dam now. That's not its
original gangster.
You know, yes, dams are often gangster-esque, but no, in this case, OG is just the type of dam. Right now, coastal cutthroat and lamprey can actually make it up over that dam, and that's why they'll be able to make it up over this one as well.
Giving them access to all of the territory upstream.
Right.
Graham and I are also standing at what has been constructed as a makeshift dam, and essentially most of the North North Fork is being channeled into like this big tube.
What has to happen when we do work in this actual stream bed itself is that we have to get all the water out of there so we don't harm any fish in the process. So this is an area we're looking at here, has a fish screen above so that no fish can swim into the area, but then also has a dam here where we actually have a rented pipe that is receiving the river, and that is taking it and actually moving it around the project site and dumping it down river to isolate our project area where we also salvaged fish out of. So we actually went in with an electroshock backpack and shocked the fish so that they, you know, they're not hurt, because they'll jump back, but they'd be in a lot worse shape if they had to be in all this turbid water and mud. And so, very important part of the project.
So, yeah, it's dry under the bridge right now, essentially.
When this project's all over, this will be removed, and the river will have a new path.
New path. Love it.
Awesome. Over the next month, that work was done in the stream bed, filling in the front of the face of the dam at that 3% grade. And the sound of the river went from this to this. And And so we went back in the middle of September for the big release of the river back into its typical flow. And also to look at that OG dam mentioned earlier, which is a potential future project, which Kyle from the hatchery talked more with us about.
So what purpose does this OG dam serve for the hatchery if it's not a water intake?
Hey guys, good to see you.
You guys up here?
Oh, we're just out, just showing off the project.
Oh, cool. We're talking about the next project, maybe?
Hopefully yeah. That's what this will be.
That's the idea, right?
That's
yeah.
The next phase.
Isn't it pretty cool?
I'm Graham, by the way.
Kyle, nice to
Kyle,
meet you.
Kyle, nice
yeah.
to meet you.
This is Anthony.
Yeah,
I think I've met you before, too.
I'm Kelly.
I'm
also with the Watershed Association.
Cool.
Yeah, we were just talking about what purpose this dam serves for the hatchery.
Nothing right now.
Nothing.
Yeah, just lets a blockage, essentially, you know, and then we put natives up and everything like that, but right now it's just a blockage.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, what was it before it was just a blockage?
So they actually ran the trap on this side over here, and they trapped in this.
Right.
Oh.
And so they would take fish, put them in a truck, and then they drive them down here to work them and everything during spawning season.
Yeah, to get your stock.
Our brood, yeah.
Totally.
Let's
amazing.
Go.
Well, that was really good timing. Thank you for the explanation.
Yeah, no problem.
Yeah, because it seems like the project that's happening now is like needs this to happen to really like fully function.
It would definitely go together for sure. Yeah, you know. I mean, this is obviously ends up being a kind of a trap place too because you know fish get stuck up here. Like in the fall is when it really happens when we get like a rain. And then it stops for like 3 weeks. And then we have 200 fish sitting up here. We've had to come up and do fish salvage out of this top end.
Wow.
You know? Just because of the way it's set up. But if it changes to that other setup, basically, I mean, they'd come up here, but they'd be able to back out easier.
We have an exciting update from January 2024 about the OG Dam. It's also getting a rough-in channel. The historian's Olivia Palmer reported that ODFW received a $3 million grant via the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, which they plan to use to design and construct a rough-in channel and possibly another fish passage structure if needed at the site, as well as other infrastructure improvements that will aim to increase efficiency of trapping returning hatchery fish. Shout out to the folks getting that good work going.
Yeah.
Okay.
With the right grade.
Where does the structure date from? Is it 50s?
That's Katie Frankowitz of KMUN.
I don't know actually when the dam itself was put in. I'm not familiar with that. I know the hatchery's 1900s, like 1912 or something like that.
That's the oldest one in the state. Cool old history and story about some family and like willing
neighbors.
It to say it had to be a hatchery in perpetuity.
Yeah, yeah.
And
that's Carla Cole. She is the stewardship director at Lewis and Clark National Historical Park.
Oh,
yeah, the story here.
Their homestead is actually the property across. Well, this was actually part of their homestead, and the property adjoining us to the south here is their homestead property, and the family's still there. So
cool.
Yeah, the Henkel family. So
cool.
Yeah, and they donated this as, like I said, as a production facility. That as long as we're raising fish on it, it stays in the department's hands. So.
Right.
Yeah. Did they cut loose the dam yet up there?
They're
in the
process.
They're in the process of it.
That's why we're here.
Yeah. See it.
Apparently it's going to be a little bit lackluster.
I think it is.
Yeah,
I mean,
like,
we were looking at the amount of flow that's actually coming through. It's only like under 200 gallons a minute. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's going to take a while to even fill all those rocks in. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not going to be like, wow, the dam broke.
Yeah, no, that's kind of what I was imagining.
Yeah. Yeah. I was hoping that in my mind, but it's not
going to
be.
I was hoping for like the Marmot Dam, you know,
yeah,
just
exactly.
blow it up
yeah.
and walk away.
Yeah.
But
walk away.
It's okay.
No dynamite today.
One.
Well, cool. Did you guys check out the fish in the river yet?
We're about to.
Walk down this side and then check them coming up into the ladder. It's the most I've seen in a long time. So,
okay.
Yeah,
that's encouraging.
Walk across them, so.
All right.
Per Kyle's advice, we walk down to the lower reaches of the hatchery, the furthest downstream point where fish were swimming upstream and trying to return to where they came from, many of which were probably birthed in the hatchery, and so we're returning there, and there were tons. Is that a chum? Look how colorful this one is. That's a chum. Oh my god, there's a chum. It's so beautiful. It was not a chum.
think that was a Chinook, actually. Mm-hmm. That was looked beat up. No, it just looked really beat up.
Oh.
Let's see it. See how it's spotted?
It does look a little.
I think that's old Thule style.
Okay. What species are these?
So these are Thule salmon, which I've learned are unique Chinook. And they're, and it took me a while to understand what people meant by Thules, but Thules are basically a lower Columbia specific fall Chinook.
Mm-hmm.
So that was.
They spawn lower in the river.
Exactly.
And they cut less bright.
Right.
They
exactly.
don't sell for as much.
So that is a native Columbia run.
Exactly.
The Thules are.
And yeah. that's why they're so.
And that's what these are.
That's what these are, yeah.
Are some of them coho? Some of them,
some of them
like
are coho. I think I saw it. So if you look up there and if you get a glimpse of like a really red back
yeah.
or kind of dark or even darker.
And that one just looks like a steelhead. Some of them look like rank trouty.
Like that was a steelhead, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, with like this sort of rainbowy trout mm-hmm. look. There's so
kind of
many.
I know.
This is nuts.
This is so cool.
It was so cool. Most hatcheries have publicly accessible areas where you can go and catch a glimpse of the fish returning. So if you haven't seen something like this and you would like to, plan a visit to a hatchery in the fall when the rains start up. This project was completed with funding from the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board and Bonneville Power Administration. Big thanks to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Resource Legacy Fund, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, the Pacific Lamprey Conservation Initiative, and Big River Excavation, who contracted with us to do the heavy lifting on this project. Now, we're going to shift gears and head downstream to the Colwort Creek Estuary at Lewis and Clark National Historical Park, where Carla Cole, the park's stewardship director, who you heard chatting with us at the Klaska 9 Hatchery earlier, talked with me about the history of the area and how they've gone about taking a horse pasture and dredge dump site back to something much closer to the complex wetland habitat it was before human development.
We originally called it the South Clatsop Slough Restoration Project back in 2007 when the first action was to remove an old tide gate and undersized culvert and replace it with a bridge and restore flow to about a 55-acre site, and we restored floodplain hydrology to about half of it when we did that.
Carla and I were standing on the South Slough Trail overlooking Colwort Creek wetland, and the floodplain hydrology she mentioned refers to the degree to which water can access the area surrounding its main channel. In habitat restoration, we often talk about habitat complexity, and when water can interact more with its floodplain, this generally creates a more complex habitat where insects can lay eggs, fish can take refuge, and where the water just has the opportunity to slow down and offload nutrients or toxins. So those tide gates she referred to, they allow water to drain from an area but don't allow it to come back in. I kind of think of them as a corset restricting the flow of water, the way corsets make it hard for the wearer to take a deep breath in, but you can exhale just fine.
Later, around 2012, we did the second project here to get kind of the southern acreage included in the floodplain restoration, and that one we named Colwort Creek.
Okay.
So all told now, there's about 55 acres of former Lewis and Clark floodplain that have been reconnected and are tidally inundated twice a day now. It had been a horse pasture up until that first action in 2007.
Right, and it was horse pasture starting when Fort Clatsop Road was put in, a dike built up to put the road on top.
Well, this whole area was started to be diked and drained for agriculture back in the 1850s or so. So the horse pasture was its most recent historical use when Fort Clatsop, when Lewis and Clark National Historical Park acquired it. But prior to that, I believe it had been a pig farm at one time. So it was an old homestead.
And so when you talk about restoring wetland hydrology, directly, that means like physically removing the tide gate and putting in the bridge so that water can pass freely, tidally from the Lewis and Clark, where Colwort Creek empties. But also there was like digging some channels and like building up some areas and digging down some areas that have to do with plant life and natural forces that would have created these things in the first place. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's really interesting here, and it's kind of why there was a phase one and phase two. So the first thing in restoration, the first action is what is commonly referred to as passive restoration, where you're really just removing the human-built infrastructure to let the natural processes do their thing again.
This is an important point in habitat restoration, that the goal for us as humans is specifically to address human-caused issues that disrupt natural processes. We're not trying to tell the land or water what to do. We want to listen when it tells us what to do. Passive restoration removes disruptive features from the landscape like tide gates, dikes, or roads, then lets nature take the wheel, while active restoration goes a step further in an effort to speed up the recovery, like planting native plants at a site.
So that's what we first did, and this whole northern half of the marsh that we're looking at now responded really beautifully to that, and it's incredible how rapidly we didn't plant anything. All these native sedges and cattails and rushes and flowering wetland plants all just started emerging once that water flow was back, and it could have been, we're not certain if it was from a buried seed bank or stuff coming in on the tide. It was probably a combination of both. Mm-hmm. So over the first few years, we monitored everything, and we were watching this northern half of the site respond really beautifully while the southern half was really kind of sitting high and dry. And what we found out is that the Lewis and Clark River, which again is just out of view on the other side of Fort Clatsop Road, historically was dredged on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. This was a big logging industrial site very close to here in Atoll Landing. Mm-hmm. And they'd have those big rafts, the big like cigar-shaped rafts and log booms, and so
yep.
In order to be able to do all the logging traffic on the river, they had, and because of the excessive sediments that were getting into the river, so they would have to dredge it on a regular basis, and they would just choose certain spots behind the dikes and levees to dump that dredge material. And so the southern half here was actually a few feet higher than the natural wetland marsh plain of the river. So even though we removed the obstacle and let the tide come in, it, because of those historic dredge spoil deposits, the southern half wasn't getting inundated. So that's why for phase two, it was a much more active restoration project than the first one. And that's where we went in and created channels and we lowered the marsh plain. And it was pretty exciting to see. I mean, that's where we went. You know, we got very specific to within feet and inches of making sure the excavators who had, you know, GPS RTKs mounted on their excavator machines.
Wow.
To dial in just the exact elevations we wanted, and where we dug it back down to low marsh to the native marsh elevation, there was an immediate response. And we just got, a diverse suite of beautiful native marsh plants in there. Where it was higher, that's where we had to do planting pretty extensively, and where we made big elk exclosure fences that were up for about 5 to 10 years to keep the elk out. But now looking out, you can see all the spruce trees and other things that we planted out there doing really well.
It did look good, and I was curious about why they had decided where to dig, how deep to dig, and why. For example, was their goal to dig deep enough so that reed canary grass wouldn't grow back?
That was one of the factors for sure. I mean, I think what we're really going for is a diversity of elevations so that we could create a continuum of different native plant communities in the estuary more than anywhere else I've ever seen. Like really, for plant communities, elevation is destiny. Like that is going to determine, you know, 3 inches higher and you're going to get a whole new native plant community. So we wanted a variety of plant communities out there. I lobbied for the low emergent marsh because as a manager, that's the easiest one for me. I don't have to plant anything and there's usually not any weeds in there. we're dealing with a little purple loosestrife and yellow iris now, but we can talk about that more later. So yeah, and then you go from low marsh to high marsh to scrub shrub willows up into the sika spruce, crab apple kind of hummocks and hillocks, and we designed it to have a variety of those elevations throughout the site with a real long-term vision of far into the future. Hopefully we're bringing back some sika spruce swamp onto the landscape, which we know from historic records and other studies that there used to be a lot more sika swamp everywhere up and down the coast, but in particular here. In fact, in some of our restoration sites, when we dig down to that old marsh plain elevation, we find buried huge sika spruce bases. So
wow.
Yeah.
And I know sika spruce swamps, like, as a habitat type, are globally rare.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And like part of that is from habitat loss from human actions. Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely. So that's one of the kind of more fun and satisfying things we get to do here at the park is try to bring some of that swamp back on the landscape.
A bit more about sika swamps. These are tidally inundated wetlands dominated by sika spruce trees, and a defining feature of a, quote, swamp is that it is dominated by forests, unlike marshes, where herbaceous vegetation like grasses prevail. You may have noticed spruce trees on walks through the Oregon coastal forests, but you may not have noticed their presence in these swampy areas, because they're mostly gone. Laura Brophy of the Institute for Applied Ecology published a paper in 2019 that examined the losses of different types of wetlands along the Oregon coast. And there's a great graphic in that paper which shows that there were around 16,000 hectares of tidal wetlands in the Oregon coast historically. And of that 16,000, over half were forested wetlands, so over 8,000 hectares of sika swamps. Now, there's only about 7,000 hectares of tidal wetland total in Oregon, but only around 700 are forested. So we've lost over 90% of our forested tidal wetlands. Why does this matter? Well, some of that knowledge is unknown. So much of this habitat was lost before the scientific community started taking stock of it. There's also a lot of current data on the subject referring to carbon sequestration. Tidal swamps of the Pacific Northwest store more carbon per acre than the average tropical or subtropical mangrove. They're actually about on par with our old growth forests in terms of carbon sequestration per acre, with the vast majority of their carbon stored underground. They contribute to habitat complexity and provide foraging opportunities for juvenile salmon, cool surface and subsurface waters, help accumulate sediments and woody debris, and support beaver activity, which can further contribute to a more functional ecosystem overall. So go hug a spruce, but maybe don't grab the needles because they'll grab you back. Thank you so much for listening to this first episode of Watershed Moments. If you want to learn more about restoration efforts happening around the North Coast Watershed Association's watersheds, you can visit our website at clatsopwatersheds.org or visit Lewis and Clark National Historical Park's website at nps.gov/lewi to learn about what they're up to. If you want to learn more about hatcheries, there's loads of information in each hatchery's annual program management plan, which you can find online. Just search the name of the hatchery plus program management plan. If you want to see us in the flesh, you can come join one of our community trainings where you can learn to use our Know Your Watersheds app to find and share information about restoration, native and non-native plants, water quality, and more. You can find those dates and locations and download the app on our website as well. That's clatsopwatersheds.org. Huge thanks to Nick Jaina for the music in this episode and to Dr. Jacob Job of the Sound and Light Ecology Team at Colorado State University and the Natural Sounds and Night Skies Division of the National Park Service for some of the amazing bird song recordings you hear in this episode. And thanks to the folks who spoke with me for this show, Graham Clagg, Kyle Wilson, and Carla Cole. I'm Kelly D. Take care, and remember, water is life. Agua es vida.